Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Simply Responsible, Basic Blame, Scant Praise, and Minimal Agency by Matt King. Narrated by Kyle Snyder. Preface. I'm the sort of reader who likes a good preface to an academic book. I'm mostly intrigued by the autobiographical history behind the work, or behind-the-scenes details regarding how it took shape. I also confess to having scanned quite a few to see if my name was mentioned. That said, if prefaces aren't for you, I won't take offense if you skip this part. I'll start with some background on how I came to write this book, and then I'll thank some folks. In the upcoming lists, I go alphabetically to help others find their names. The main idea of this book first took shape way back in graduate school. Like many who think and write about responsibility, I was immediately animated reading Peter Strawson's Freedom and Resentment. I had started out as a political philosopher, thinking largely about issues of political legitimacy. But I soon found myself thinking about our ordinary practices of holding each other responsible, especially Strawson's methodology of looking to when it would be inappropriate to hold others responsible as a means to uncovering the conditions on being responsible. I couldn't help noticing that our ordinary practices extend well beyond moral cases exhibiting good and ill will toward others, and I was struck by the many parallels I saw across domains. I came to believe that non-moral cases of responsibility were as theoretically significant as the moral ones. This led me toward a project much in Strawson's spirit, I suppose, but with a very different structure in the end. A dissertation followed, defending a compatibilist account of responsibility, using many of those same observations of symmetry. But, as with many dissertations, the discussion was a bit programmatic, and it certainly was a bit too full of itself. In subsequent years, I was fortunate to successfully publish work on a number of topics regarding responsibility. However, the broader project I'd begun in the dissertation didn't really figure directly into any of it. It was still there in my thinking, of course. It was just operating in the background in ways that didn't affect those arguments, I hope. So, I've been thinking about responsibility for almost 20 years, and it has taken that long for me to develop that basic view into something presentable. If you are one of the 6 people who read my dissertation, you'll no doubt recognize many familiar ideas and themes. But I hope you will also appreciate the ways in which the ideas are more refined and the theory more mature. For the rest of you, you'll be no worse off for having missed my earlier offering, though some of you may wish I'd taken even longer. Introduction. A General Theory of Responsibility. This book is about responsibility. Moral responsibility is serious business. Holding others responsible for their actions is central to our ordinary practices. We blame, we praise, we decry, we applaud, we punish, we pin stars. When someone wrongs us or shows us great kindness, we respond with our anger or gratitude accordingly, blaming or praising them for their deeds. However, our ordinary practices are not limited to moral actions. We also hold people responsible for a wide range of non-moral activities. We cheer the catch, and we boo the ref. We give 1-star reviews, and we commend the chef. The radical proposal for this book is that the blameworthy artist is responsible in just the same way that the blameworthy thief is. We can be responsible for all kinds of different activities, from lip-syncing to long division, from murders to meringues. But the relation involved, what I'll call the basic responsibility relation, is the same in every case. We are responsible for the things we do first, then blameworthy or praiseworthy for having done them in the light of whether they're good or bad, according to a variety of standards. Why is this a radical proposal? Firstly, because so much of the contemporary literature on moral responsibility has moralized its nature. According to the vast majority of accounts, moral responsibility is either a special species of responsibility or else depends on moralized capacities. In contrast, I think that we get a more complete and unifying picture of responsible agency from a more general theory of responsibility. Secondly, the proposal is radical due to its drastic simplicity. I forego many of the complications that feature in other accounts of responsibility, arguing that we can make do with less demanding theoretical elements. The resulting account is exceedingly minimal, and yet I remain attached to its numerous virtues and explanatory strengths. An initial case study. Some years ago, I attended a performance of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, put on by my local orchestra. It's a favorite of mine, and a familiar one, especially that opening phrase, deservedly recognized as a masterpiece. That night, it was superbly performed by the orchestra. At its conclusion, there was a standing ovation that persisted for some time. There was also, if memory serves, a good bit of whistling, hooting, and a smidge of hurrahing. It struck me at the time that I was doing, at least, two separate things. One, I was applauding the orchestra, who had so admirably executed a wonderful piece of music. Two, I was standing in admiration of the piece of music itself, directing acclaim at Beethoven, the composer. This seems to me to make perfect sense. The composition is amazing in its own right, and would remain so, even if a particular performance missed the mark. But the orchestra's performance is separable from the composition in the other direction as well. The symphony is inert until brought to life by the performance, and, as aficionados will tell you, there is much room for interpretation in an orchestral score. That the performance was so lovely was a credit to the orchestra and its members, quite apart from Beethoven's contribution. At this stage, I want to make but two brief points about this, dare I say, ordinary example. First, there are many different sorts of things for which we can be celebrated. Composing a great caprice, for instance, is one sort of thing. Performing that caprice is another. If one thinks about it, there isn't a whole lot that composition has in common with performance, and, of course, one can be a great performer without being a great composer, and vice versa. But our praise is not limited to great works of art. We are celebrated for our contributions at work, the cake we bake, and the shots we make. There's a great diversity too, and broad range of things for which we are praised. These observations extend to the negative side of things as well. We are criticized for our cooking, our trip planning, and our mismanagement of money or time. There is no less diversity here. The second point I want to make is that there is also a wide and diverse range of ways in which we celebrate others. We applaud, but also hoot and holler. We fête. We write moving tributes. We smile. We cheer. We stand in awe, and we hand out trophies. Again, there isn't much that cheering has in common with handing over a bronze statuette, yet both are ways by which we give praise. Similar claims apply, again, to the negative side of things. We boo. We give negative reviews. We jeer and call out others. We mark down. We feel our ire rise, and we impose penalties. Again, there is extraordinary diversity, and yet all are ways of disparaging others. I make these observations at the outset to indicate the set of phenomena with which I'm interested. We blame and praise each other throughout a remarkable range of human endeavors, an incredibly diverse set of activities taking place within a staggering array of domains, across academic, artistic, and athletic domains. Just to stick with A. We commend and condemn, acclaim and accuse, give props and throw shade. It strikes me that we clearly hold each other responsible for what we do in all these areas. My starting point, then, is the whole range of human activity, though I will often privilege artistic and athletic cases to keep the discussion focused. Importantly, a guiding idea of this book is that the entire set of human activity, while broad and diffuse, is nonetheless fundamentally unified. There is no special moral realm of enterprise. Rather, we do things in the world that can be assessed in a variety of ways. We are not morally responsible for some things we do. We are simply responsible for them, and some of them turn out to be morally evaluable. What's in a name? Philosophical work on moral responsibility has exploded in the last 25 years or so. In that time, numerous families of theories, styles of approaches, and an increasing diversity of distinctions have proliferated. It has become commonplace to situate one's own account within a panoply of trademarked camps or pick one's team in a series of debated distinctions. While I will, of course, place my view in contemporary context, I'm driven more by a distinctive methodology and the theoretical virtues of generality and simplicity than by the signposts and guardrails placed by extant discussions. The central conceit of this book is that our best theory of responsibility should be developed out of a fuller range of cases across a broader set of domains. I don't pretend to theorize in a vacuum, but I do explicitly seek a greater level of generality than most mainstream work. Indeed, despite all the diversification in the literature, the vast majority of theories are designed as theories of moral responsibility. They are organized around cases of moral significance and moral evaluation, actions that are either morally bad or wrong. Indeed, even moral praise has been given short shrift. For example, Michael McKenna considers that perhaps there is a distant notion of personal responsibility between intimates or professional responsibility, another that concerns aesthetic commitments or athletic commitments or matters of etiquette, 2012, page 7, before setting such considerations aside. R.J. Wallace admits that we praise an artist's striking and successful work of art, such that our praise and admiration reflect a kind of credit on its creator, and that we can condemn the pianist's latest performance in a way that reflects discredit on the pianist, but dismisses such cases because this kind of direct appraisal does not seem especially moral in its quality. 1994, pages 53 to 54. More often, a theory's default concern is with the moral cases, and so the parallel instances aren't explicitly addressed. This focus is, in one sense, perfectly understandable, since what motivates our consideration of questions of responsibility is so often its moral dimensions. It is cases of wrongdoing and punishment, of viciousness and harm, that so animate our initial interest. It is thus unsurprising that many would begin with the moral. Nevertheless, neglecting the non-moral cases risks myopia. If we limit our gaze to morally significant actions, it can appear obvious that non-moral cases aren't relevant to developing a theory of moral responsibility. Indeed, it is common for theorists to simply stipulate that their theoretical focus is on moral responsibility. One advantage of such a move is that it clarifies one's project at the outset. Responsibility is a particularly nebulous and shifty topic. The ways in which we talk about responsibility are richly ambiguous, suggesting subtle but potentially important differences. An attractive approach to such a nebulous topic is to start with some stipulations in an effort to make the questions more tractable and narrow the field of inquiry. A significant drawback of such an approach, however, is that stipulations restrict the theoretical possibilities. For instance, an approach that concerns itself with blameworthiness alone denies itself potential resources that may be revealed by examining praiseworthiness. If a view constricts its focus to moral cases alone, it excludes the possibility that non-moral cases may shed additional light on the conditions on moral responsibility. Indeed, even stipulating the sense of responsibility one is investigating presumes there are different sorts of responsibility to give an account of, and that they are indeed separable. Regardless, while there may well be multiple kinds of responsibility, I don't want to bias that question by fiat in characterizing the project. A major objective in the discussion to come is to clarify the notion of responsibility underlying agential assessment across evaluative domains. Of course, theorists have discretion over the starting points of their theories or in addressing the phenomena in which they're interested. But they do so at their own peril. For theories are not constrained solely by what they set out to explain. For example, I am writing this in my home in Alabama, which has coastline on the Gulf of Mexico. As a result, we often pay attention to hurricane activity. Though I am unlikely to face a hurricane directly where I live, these powerful storms yield indirect effects. They pose significant threats to nearby areas and affect local weather patterns, including increasing the risk of flooding or tornadoes. So, while I don't worry about hurricanes per se, they are relevant to my concerns. Indeed, since moving here in 2014, there have been two hurricane remnants that have passed through town as tropical depressions after making landfall, and many more have come nearby. In contrast, I don't worry about typhoons at all. Typhoons are Pacific tropical storms, between 100 and 180 degrees longitude. They occur very far away from my home in Alabama and tend to move from east to west, in other words, further away from me. While such storms might produce incidental effects on my weather or well-being, these are very unlikely to be significant enough for me to pay attention to. For the record, typhoons are limited to the northern hemisphere. Storms in the southern Indian or southwestern Pacific Oceans are simply called by the generic cyclone. So, if you live in Alabama, you worry about hurricanes. In Japan, it's typhoons, and Tongans should be on the lookout for cyclones. If we want to give an account of tropical cyclones, however, it won't do to limit our gaze to hurricanes. Even if we begin with only an interest in Caribbean storms, even if we generate a perfectly adequate account of Caribbean storms, our explanations will plausibly not be limited to Caribbean phenomena. Given the similarities between hurricanes, typhoons, and cyclones, we should want to explain those similarities. Thus, an account of cyclones ought to explain not just hurricanes, but typhoons as well. Though focused on meteorological phenomena, there is an instructive methodological lesson here. Theories seek to unify a range of phenomena under general explanations. More general theories, naturally, seek to unify a broader range of phenomena under more general explanations. My proposal here is to seek a more general explanation of both moral and non-moral conduct. I'll argue that the parallels between moral and non-moral evaluation reveal an underlying commonality, what I'll call the basic responsibility relation. I may be mistaken, of course. Perhaps moral blameworthiness and praiseworthiness really are distinctive, and moral responsibility is its own special relation. But there is a difference between objecting to a general account and dismissing it. One cannot dismiss planetary motion whilst defending Galileo over Newton, insisting that one is only concerned with the motion of falling bodies, or ignore Maxwell's account of electromagnetism by stipulating an interest in electricity alone. Likewise, one cannot dismiss my approach because one thinks the non-moral cases are irrelevant to moral responsibility. For even if they are clearly relevant to a more general theory. Being responsible. The goal of the present project, in any case, is to present a positive general theory of responsibility, and I will thus say relatively little up front to sharpen the concept. Nevertheless, there are some general remarks to help set expectations. By way of orienting the discussion, it's important to signal that my primary interest concerns what it takes to be responsible, in the sense that Beethoven is responsible for his Fifth Symphony, and the orchestra was responsible for that performance. I consider this to be the principal question for a theory of responsibility, one explanatorily prior to questions about the appropriateness of holding someone responsible. Responsibility of this sort concerns, among other things, the problem of free will, our ability to exert meaningful control over what we do, to author our own stories, and to be genuinely worthy of the evaluations others make of us. These features, however, while undeniably crucial to our moral practices, are far more general than this. They speak to our natures as agents, beings who act in the world to create art, advance science, achieve great feats of athletic prowess, and, yes, do moral evil as well as good. While I will consult our practices of holding each other responsible in what follows, I take those practices to be of secondary explanatory importance. This is not because they are less important. On the contrary, they figure into some of the most significant ways we relate to one another. Though, crucially, they do not exhaust those ways. But my aim is not to justify our practices. Instead, I enlist them in service of getting clearer about being responsible. Thus, for me, the justification of our practices and all the contours of their particular elements is importantly a separate question, or set of questions. Admittedly, even designating this set of practices as the category of holding responsible is imperfect, given, as it does, its stronger affinity for the negative side of things. It is somewhat odd, for instance, to say that when we give out an Emmy, we are thereby holding the performer responsible for her performance. But, for all that, I think it clear that we take such performers to be responsible for their performances, and, if they were not, we would have clear grounds for denying them the award. It is therefore perhaps most accurate to say that I begin with a distinction between what it takes to be responsible and how we ought to respond to the responsible. These responses, how we treat the blameworthy and praiseworthy, the ways in which we take their responsibility to be significant, can all count as responsibility-related elements of our practices. Yet, despite being related to responsibility, it doesn't follow that this diverse and disparate set of practices should be the principal province of theories of responsibility. We view and relate to each other in various ways, as subjects of a life, as moral patients, as embedded in relationships, friends, family, teammates, as inhabiting roles, citizen, shopkeeper, artist, as sources of interdependence, as minded creatures with complex attitudes and emotions, etc. I cannot hope to address all these features that bear on our interpersonal interactions, nor do I think they must all be central to a theory of responsibility, especially if that theory is aiming at a suitable level of generality. What I propose is starting with a way that we relate to the world around us, saving these interpersonal dynamics for later stage theorizing. My framing of the issues, then, is essentially metaphysical. Strawson, 1962, may have been right that there is much about relating to other persons that is insulated from panicky metaphysics, but there is also something centrally relevant to how we interact with the world. In my view, when we are responsible for things, it is our connection to those things that matters, and that relation is primarily metaphysical. One way to approach this idea clearly is to think about the notions of apology and forgiveness. One could insist that both are central elements of a theory of responsibility. I think they are better conceived as constituents of a broader domain regarding the dynamics of our responses to those responsible for things, one which far outstrips the boundaries of, for lack of a better term, the responsibility domain. As some initial evidence for this priority, notice that we remain responsible and blameworthy for the things we've done, even when we're forgiven for them, and it often makes perfect sense to apologize for things for which we aren't responsible. Damage produced by our child, an innocent but consequential mistake. Naturally, our more general theories will have to accommodate facts about apology and forgiveness, but that is to be expected. Indeed, to the extent that non-moral apology abounds, a player might apologize to a teammate for dropping a pass and be subsequently forgiven. The general framework I'm providing may prove fruitful beyond what I set out to explore here. Nevertheless, I will leave a detailed consideration of the complicated dynamics involved in the fuller range of our responses to the responsible for later work, though I will at times revisit this theme in the chapters to come. In particular, I'll consider the relevance of justifying punishment in Chapter 4. For similar reasons to those regarding apology and forgiveness, I'll argue that the appropriateness of punishment is largely orthogonal to a theory of responsibility. For now, I'll note that questions of punishment are inapt across a wide swath of human activity in which we are seemingly nonetheless responsible. There are, of course, different ways we might seek more generality from a theory of responsibility. Thus, I acknowledge at the outset that my approach isn't necessarily the only sort of worthwhile generalization. Different strategies may yield different virtues worth considering. Nevertheless, my initial interest is in consulting the broader set of activities in which we're responsible. If there are commonalities between being responsible for the moral things we do and, say, the artistic ones, those commonalities are worth exploring. And investigating these commonalities directs us toward a more general theory of responsibility. An argument in two keys. In what follows, I develop that general theory. I argue that despite its simplicity, the basic responsibility relation figures in an attractive and explanatorily powerful account of responsibility, one that warrants consideration amidst competing accounts of moral responsibility. Thus, the main way to take the project of the book is as a defense of a thoroughly minimalist theory of responsibility, necessary to explaining the wide set of data, /cases, /explananda. In this major key, one objective of the book is to reorient how we should theorize about moral responsibility. However, I recognize that some listeners may balk at my attempt to appeal to non-moral cases, or otherwise reject that, at least some of, the things I claim need explaining, really need explaining by a theory of moral responsibility. Others may complain that the distinctiveness of moral responsibility is the thing to be explained, and that giving it up is a cost to be avoided. In an effort to nonetheless bring something of value to such audiences, I offer a second interpretation. One can instead treat the book's project as taking a conjecture and exploring how much work it can do. In this minor key, the aim is to demonstrate how many resources a rather simple sort of picture about responsibility has, even if that picture doesn't ultimately capture all you might want your theory of moral responsibility to explain. Though I will argue that where the view doesn't deliver on some element of our practices, we have independent reasons to be suspicious of those elements, or else that they should be captured independent of a theory of responsibility. Those unpersuaded are free to treat the basic responsibility relation as being foundational to their own preferred responsibility framework. Both interpretations are equally conditional on the basic responsibility relation, but the minor key gives one more room to disagree with the initial framework. Regardless of which key one favors, I hope that even where I'm wrong in what follows, I am wrong in interesting and productive ways. And for those that choose the minor key, I hope to demonstrate the merits of transposing into the major along the way. No matter the key, my aim is to defend the argument with a minimum of technical jargon or theoretical formulations. This can be potentially off-putting. It risks implying that I'm ignoring swaths of a literature which has carefully regimented our understanding of action, intentionality, responsibility, and blame. I hope to manage without such an intricate infrastructure. To assuage some worries, however, I will gesture toward ways in which the framework I develop can be fit into some of the more familiar philosophical apparatus. In most cases, the elements of the theory I propose are compatible with various ways of developing the details. Indeed, one main strength of the theory to come rests on its relative simplicity and the generality of its scope. These are virtues worth preserving, even if we encounter some counterintuitive results. The standard problem for such a view is that it leaves something out. The more minimal a theory is, the more likely it is to lack various resources, resources we may need in order to explain important phenomena. It would have been simpler to stop physical ontology at protons, neutrons, and electrons, but these particles appear unable to handle certain complex phenomena. Consequently, I will often focus in what follows on elements of our blaming and praising practices that seem unaddressed by my account. I argue that once we appropriately clarify the nature of these elements, three solutions typically suffice. First, the element is easily accounted for by the theory, so presents no special explanatory difficulty. Second,
sample complete. Ready to continue?